This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart. In 2010, Vijaya Thakur was working at a human rights NGO that focused on the Democratic Republic of Congo. She worked closely with lawmakers whom she'd grown up idolizing. She drafted legislation that would offer relief to Congolese citizens, but Vijaya started doubting that her work was actually doing anything.
No matter how many victories we stacked up in terms of getting laws passed, either here on the Hill or at the UN, it never seemed to reach the people who were most affected by conflict.
Meanwhile, San Diego native Dan Driscoll was living in a small village in Morocco during a stint with the Peace Corps. He made friends with some local artisans, and repeatedly he'd see them being taken advantage of by foreign art dealers.
They go around from, you know, town to town, they buy a product at whatever price they ask for, and they turn around and they sell it in the States for, you know, what they call a fair price, but it can be anywhere between 200 to 1,000% markup.
While in Norfolk, Virginia, Scott Nelson was a dot-com boomer turned stay-at-home dad.
And after about, 6 months, I just went completely stir-crazy and just had a hard time just sitting still. So I just started figuring out, you know, what could I do while my kids are sleeping.
Now, all three of these people are doing a fundamental human activity, identifying problems. And they're also looking for solutions. Vijaya, fed up with how Congo relief effort was shaking down, started her own NGO called the Resolve Network.
In our first year, we worked with 50 women, helping them start their own small businesses. And through them, we were able to help over 500 people rise out of extreme global poverty.
Dan, in Morocco, helped artists there earn more money by building a website called Anu.
Anu is an online platform designed specifically for computer illiterate artists and artisans so that they are able to use the internet to sell their products abroad independently.
And Scott, the stay-at-home dad, started building a solar steam engine.
And basically what that does is it focuses sunlight onto water, turns the water into steam, and the steam compresses, turns a steam engine. That steam engine turns a generator. And
today on our program, we're asking, where do ideas come from? What's the origin of our innovations?
I would think that ideas come from when people find a problem that hasn't been solved. Not necessarily looking for a solution, but finding the right problem to fix.
When you let go of your notions of what's possible and what's not, and you just let yourself explore, I think that's where ideas come from.
I'm fairly convinced that ideas are born from other ideas. Homo erectus, they had like one tool. They had this hand axe. It was basically a sharpened rock. There was one guy that was like, hey, let's sharpen this rock. That idea lasted for a million years.
Hang on to this image of a sharpened rock, because science writer Matt Ridley says that is the key to understanding where ideas come from. First, let's start with Matt's broader assertion, which he made at his 2010 TED Talk, that ideas come from pretty much the same place that babies do.
In other words, you need to understand how ideas have sex.
Matt Ridley, welcome to the TED Radio Hour.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Matt, you have to explain to me what you mean by ideas having sex.
Well, if sex didn't exist, you wouldn't get nearly such progress in evolution. You wouldn't get such complexity in bodies, because what sex does is it enables you to draw upon genetic inventions anywhere in your species. You're drawing upon genetic mutations that happen anywhere. And I'm saying that exchange had the same impact on our culture that sex had on our biology. It accelerated cultural evolution the same way that sex accelerated biological evolution.
In your talk, Matt, you show a really fascinating slide of a tear egg-shaped primitive tool.
It's an Acheulean hand axe from 500,000 years ago of the kind made by Homo erectus.
And a computer mouse.
A computer mouse. They're both exactly the same size and shape to an uncanny degree. I've tried to work out which is bigger. It's almost impossible.
So, Matt, what do a hand axe and a computer mouse have to do with ideas having sex?
I'd always been fascinated by this thing called the Acheulean hand axe, which was kind of the basic human technology that we had for about 1,000,000 years when we were called Homo erectus, between about 1.5 million and 500,000 years ago. I suddenly realized that it was exactly the same shape and size as the computer mouse next to it. So if you imagine a standard wireless computer mouse, that's the size and shape of an Acheulean hand axe. The similarity is what catches your eye between the mouse and the axe. But in my talk, I kind of say it's the similarity that's not interesting.
The differences are what interest me, because the one on the left was made to a pretty unvarying design for about 1,000,000 years. There was no progress, no innovation. It's an extraordinary phenomenon, but it's true, whereas the object on the right is obsolete after 5 years. And there's another difference, too, which is the object on the left is made from one substance. The object on the right is made from a confection of different substances, from silicon and metal and plastic and so on. And more than that, it's a confection of different ideas. The idea of plastic, the idea of a laser, the idea of transistors, they've all been combined together in this technology. And it's this combination, this cumulative technology that intrigues me, because I think it's the secret to understanding what's happening in the world. What's the process that's having the same effect in cultural evolution as sex is having in biological evolution? And I think the answer is exchange. The habit of exchanging one thing for another. It's a unique human feature. No other animal does it. You can teach them in the laboratory to do a little bit of exchange, and indeed there's reciprocity in other animals, but the exchange of one object for another never happens. As Adam Smith said, no man ever saw a dog make a fair exchange of a bone with another dog. Adam takes 4 hours to make a spear and 3 hours to make an axe. Oz takes 1 hour to make a spear and 2 hours to make an axe. So Oz is better at both spears and axes than Adam. He doesn't need Adam. He can make his own spears and axes. Well, no, because if you think about it, if Oz makes 2 spears and Adam makes 2 axes, and then they trade, then they will each have saved an hour of work. And the more they do this, the more true it's going to be. Because the more they do this, the better Adam is going to get at making axes, and the better Oz is going to get at making spears, so the gains from trade are only going to grow. And this is one of the beauties of exchange, is it actually creates the momentum for more specialization, which creates the momentum for more exchange, and so on. Adam and Oz both saved an hour of time. That is prosperity, the saving of time in satisfying your needs. Ask yourself how long you would have to work to provide for yourself an hour of reading light this evening to read a book by. If you had to start from scratch, let's say you go out into the countryside, you find a sheep, you kill it, you get the fat out of it, you render it down, you make a candle, etc., etc. How long is it going to take you? Quite a long time. How long do you actually have to work to earn an hour of reading light if you're on the average wage in Britain today? And the answer is about half a second. Back in 1950, you would have had to work for 8 seconds on the average wage to acquire that much light. And that's 7.5 seconds of prosperity that you've gained since 1950, as it were, because that's 7.5 seconds in which you can do something else, acquire another good or service. Back in 1800, you'd have had to work 6 hours to earn a candle that could burn for an hour. In other words, the average person on the average wage could not afford a candle in 1800.
Can you explain why you measure prosperity in terms of time?
Yes, this was an insight that's occurred to a lot of people in the economics profession before. This is what economic prosperity, economic growth is. It's a reduction in the amount of time it takes to fulfill a need. And that's how we fit so much consumption into our lives, is by reducing the amount of time it takes to earn it. So I think in the end, the real measure of how well off you are is how long you have to work to fulfill a need, or indeed a luxury. The difference between a need and a luxury, it becomes blurred. In the case of artificial light was a luxury 200 years ago. Today, it's pretty well a necessity.
Go back to this image of the axe and the mouse and ask yourself, who made them and for who? The stone axe was made by someone for himself. It was self-sufficiency. We call that poverty these days. But the object on the right was made for me by other people. How many other people? Tens? Hundreds? Thousands? You know, I think it's probably millions. Because you've got to include the man who grew the coffee, which was brewed for the man who was on the oil rig, who was drilling for oil, which was going to be made into the plastic, etc. They were all working for me, to make a mouse for me. In the case of the stone axe, the man who made it knew how to make it. But who knows how to make a computer mouse? Nobody. Literally nobody. There is nobody on the planet who knows how to make a computer mouse. I mean this quite seriously. The president of the computer mouse company doesn't know. He just knows how to run a company. The person on the assembly line doesn't know because he doesn't know how to drill an oil well to get oil out to make plastic, and so on. We all know little bits, but none of us knows the whole. And what we've done in human society through exchange and specialization is we've created the ability to do things that we don't even understand. It's not the same with language. With language, we have to transfer ideas that we understand with each other. With technology, we can actually do things that are beyond our capabilities.
In describing this true exchange of ideas, you describe all the benefits that come from it. But couldn't bad ideas have sex too?
Yes, that's absolutely true. And of course, you know, you can combine two bad ideas and come up with a worse kind of bomb. But there is a sense in which the more you share ideas, the more transparent you are, the more open you are, the more the good guys can use them and the less the bad guys can. I had a nice example of this recently when I got a computer virus on my laptop. And I went on a website to find out how to solve this on someone else's computer. And there I found right up-to-date chat rooms talking about this virus and about how to solve the latest version of it that people were sharing. People were sharing how the solutions to this problem. Now, the bad guys can't share their solutions to the solutions. They can, you know, a few of them can get together and privately email each other about them, but they can't put them out there. Otherwise, it's, you know, it makes the virus useless. So there's a sense in which sunlight is a great disinfectant on the internet and in the affairs of human beings generally. I think that the openness of people to other ideas has, on the whole, allowed good ideas to spread faster than bad ideas. Because for a bad idea to spread, someone's got to benefit from it. And on the whole, the problem with a bad idea is that a lot of people are not benefiting from it. In fact, they're being harmed by it. So they're not going to spread it.
It's the interchange of ideas, the meeting and mating of ideas, that is causing technological progress incrementally, bit by bit, however bad things happen. And in the future, as we go forward, we will, of course, experience terrible things. There will be wars, there will be depressions, there will be natural disasters. Awful things will happen in this century, I'm absolutely sure. But I'm also sure that because of the connections people are making and the ability of ideas to meet and to mate as never before, I'm also sure that technology will advance and therefore living standards will advance. Thank you.
Science writer Matt Ridley is the author of The Rational Optimist, Nature Via Nurture, as well as other books. Matt, thanks for being with us on the TED Radio Hour.
Thank you for having me on the TED Radio Hour.
Coming up next, how can we listen better to ideas from the quieter voices in the room?
When it comes to creativity and to leadership, we need introverts doing what they do best.
The power of introverts and how we undervalue their ideas when we continue with the TED Radio Hour from NPR. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart. Today on the program, we're asking where ideas come from. One place to start is TED.
What TED celebrates is the gift of the human imagination.
Everything we think,
we've had to believe in impossible things.
Infinite possibility and that sense of potential.
And
I realize
we've had to refuse to fear failure.
You've got to persist through failure.
Vulnerability is
the miracle of your mind.
Measurement of courage.
What is a conscious mind?
Can contemplate the meaning of infinity.
And I thought that was an idea worth spreading. Thank you.
Writer Susan Cain shared a big idea at TED earlier this year, although she prefers listening to speaking.
That's a lot harder for me because, as honored as I am to be here with all of you right now, this is not my natural milieu.
Susan Cain, like an estimated one-third of the people we all know, is an introvert. And she makes a powerful argument that we live in a world that undervalues introverts and their ideas. We'll talk to Susan in just a minute. But first, let's hear the start of her 2012 TED Talk.
When I was 9 years old, I went off to summer camp for the first time, and my mother packed me a suitcase full of books, which to me seemed like a perfectly natural thing to do, because in my family, reading was the primary group activity. And this might sound antisocial to you, but for us, it was really just a different way of being social. You had the animal warmth of your family sitting right next to you, but you were also free to go roaming around the adventure land inside your own mind. And I had this idea that camp was going to be just like this, but better. Camp was more like a keg party without any alcohol. And on the very first day, our counselor gathered us all together, and she taught us a cheer that she said we would be doing every day for the rest of the summer to instill camp spirit. And it went like this. R-O-W-D-I-E, that's the way we spell rowdy, 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 let's get rowdy. So I couldn't figure out for the life of me why we were supposed to be so rowdy, or why we had to spell this word incorrectly. But I recited the cheer. I recited the cheer along with everybody else. I did my best. And I just waited for the time that I could go off and read my books. But the first time that I took my book out of my suitcase, the coolest girl in the bunk came up to me and she asked me, "Why are you being so mellow?" Mellow, of course, being the exact opposite of R-O-W-D-I-E. And then the second time I tried it, the counselor came up to me with a concerned expression on her face, and she repeated the point about camp spirit and said we should all really work very hard to be outgoing.
Susan Cain, welcome to the TED Radio Hour.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here, Allison.
Do you remember at that point what you felt like?
How did I feel? You know, I know that I had a kind of sinking feeling. But in a way, like, I think even by then, you know, I was about 9 at the time. So I had learned to take those kinds of moments in stride. So it's like, you know, a moment of deflation, mm-hmm. and then you kind of keep going. And in a way, to me, that was the point of telling the story. Like, I was telling one story among many that I could have told. Like, I think as a quieter child, you're constantly having moments like this. And so you learn to adapt to them, and you're not even kind of aware consciously of what you're adapting to, but it's what they add up to over time, in a way, that was the point of my talk, because over time they add up to this sense that your preference of how you want to spend your time is somehow wrong. And you know, in my case, that led me into a kind of career path that wasn't even really right for me. You know, I ended up becoming a Wall Street lawyer for a long time. And that is partly because I had sort of learned to not trust my own instincts.
And I was always going off to crowded bars when I really would have preferred to just have a nice dinner with friends. And I made these self-negating choices so reflexively that I wasn't even aware that I was making them. Now, this is what many introverts do. And it's our loss, for sure. But it is also our colleagues' loss and our community's loss. And at the risk of sounding grandiose, it is the world's loss, because when it comes to creativity and to leadership, we need introverts doing what they do best. A third to a half of the population are introverts. A third to a half. So that's one out of every 2 or 3 people you know. So even if you're an extrovert yourself, you know, I'm talking about your coworkers and your spouses and your children and the person sitting right next to you right now, all of them subject to this bias that is pretty deep and real in our society. We all internalize it from a very early age without even having a language for what we're doing. Now, to see the bias clearly, you need to understand what introversion is. And it's different from being shy. Shyness is about fear of social judgment. Introversion is more about how do you respond to stimulation, including social stimulation. So extroverts really crave large amounts of stimulation, whereas introverts feel at their most alive and they're most switched on and they're most capable when they're in quieter, more low-key environments. Not all the time, you know, these things are an absolute, but a lot of the time.
In your TED Talk, you talk a lot about bias. And it made me wonder, from your research, did you find that there's a bias against introverts, or is the bias towards extroverts?
Oh, gosh, that's such an interesting way of asking the question. Yeah, you know, I think it's a little bit of both. But absolutely, there is a bias towards introverts per se. I mean, you know, I think introversion is often seen as being inferior and in some cases pathological. Hmm. I mean, like literally in the field of psychology, even the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, has all these different categories of various forms of mental illness. And some people in past years have put forward the idea that there should be a category for introversion, you know, which, and then other psychologists responded by saying, you know, half the profession would be considered mentally ill if you said this, because a lot of us are introverts. But yeah, I think that's often the way it's seen.
So the key then to maximizing our talents is for us all to put ourselves in the zone of stimulation that is right for us. But now here's where the bias comes in. Our most important institutions, our schools and our workplaces, they are designed mostly for extroverts, and for extroverts' need for lots of stimulation. And also, we are living through this belief system. We have a belief system right now that I call the new groupthink, which holds that all creativity and all productivity comes from a very oddly gregarious place. So if you picture the typical classroom nowadays, when I was going to school, we sat in rows. We sat in rows of desks like this, and we did most of our work pretty autonomously. But nowadays, your typical classroom has pods of desks of 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 kids all facing each other. And kids are working in countless group assignments, even in subjects like math and creative writing, which you would think would depend on solo flights of thought. Kids are now expected to act as committee members. And for the kids who prefer to go off by themselves or just to work alone, those kids are seen as outliers often, or worse, as problem cases. And the vast majority of teachers reports believing that the ideal student is an extrovert as opposed to an introvert, even though introverts actually get better grades and are more knowledgeable, according to research. Okay, same thing is true in our workplaces. We now, most of us, work in open plan offices without walls, where we are subject to the constant noise and gaze of our coworkers. And when it comes to leadership, introverts are routinely passed over for leadership positions, even though introverts tend to be very careful, much less likely to take outsized risks, which is something we might all favor nowadays. And interesting research by Adam Grant at the Wharton School has found that introverted leaders often deliver better outcomes than extroverts do, because when they are managing proactive employees, they're much more likely to let those employees run with their ideas, whereas an extrovert can quite unwittingly kind of get so excited about things that they're putting their own stamp on things, and other people's ideas might not as easily then bubble up to the surface.
In your TED Talk, you describe some of the great results that introverts get.
Yeah.
And in a world where people like to measure things, mm-hmm. I'm wondering why they don't get credit. I'm curious why that is.
Yeah. You know, I think that the individual introverts who attain great levels of success, they get all the credit in the world. I think that we just don't realize often, or we don't think about the fact that they're introverts.
Gotcha.
When they do it. So, you know, you look at Larry Page running Google, Stephen Wozniak, who created the first Apple computer, Rosa Parks, Eleanor Roosevelt, Gandhi, all these transformative leaders who are introverts. That's not the first word that we use to associate them with. But in fact, when I started looking at a lot of these people's life histories, you realize that what they did, not in spite of being introverts, but because they were introverts. You know, there was something about their quieter way of being that actually helped them achieve what they did. And that was what was so interesting to me.
For the record, though, Susan, you do not hate extroverts.
Oh, my gosh. No, not at all.
Being facetious a little bit.
No, but, you know, you're being facetious, but people actually...
Have they asked you that?
Oh, yeah. And sometimes people ask me that in all seriousness. And so I'm really glad you brought it up, because it's not that at all. You know, I'm married to an extrovert. Many of my best friends are extroverts. And I really love the company of extroverts, so that's not my point at all. For me, this is really analogous to the women's movement in the 1950s or 1960s, where the point was to raise up women. The point wasn't to bring men down, mm-hmm. But the point was to have a society where we had more of a yin and yang between women and men. And I have the same goal for introverts and extroverts. I think we need much more of a yin and a yang. I think that the best groups and the best partnerships often function effectively when you have introverts and extroverts working together. So what I'd like to see is a world where we're valuing both kinds equally.
Now, this is especially important when it comes to creativity and to productivity, because when psychologists look at the lives of the most creative people, what they find are people who are very good at exchanging ideas and advancing ideas, but who also have a serious streak of introversion in them. And this is because solitude is a crucial ingredient often to creativity. So Darwin, you know, he took long walks alone in the woods and emphatically turned down dinner party invitations. Theodore Geisel, better known as Dr. Seuss, he dreamed up many of his amazing creations in a lonely bell tower office that he had in the back of his house in La Jolla, California. And he was actually afraid to meet the young children who read his books for fear that they were expecting him to be this kind of jolly Santa Claus-like figure and would be disappointed with his more reserved persona. Steve Wozniak invented the first Apple computer sitting alone in his cubicle in Hewlett-Packard, where he was working at the time. And he says that he never would have become such an expert in the first place had he not been too introverted to leave the house when he was growing up. Now, of course, this does not mean that we should all stop collaborating. And case in point is Steve Wozniak famously coming together with Steve Jobs to start Apple Computer. But it does mean that solitude matters. And that for some people, it is the air that they breathe. And in fact, we have known for centuries about the transcendent power of solitude. It's only recently that we've strangely begun to forget it. If you look at most of the world's major religions, you will find seekers, Moses, Jesus, Buddha, Mohammed, Seekers who are going off by themselves, alone, to the wilderness, where they then have profound epiphanies and revelations that they then bring back to the rest of the community. So no wilderness, no revelations. This is no surprise, though, if you look at the insights of contemporary psychology. You know, it turns out that we can't even be in a group of people without instinctively mirroring and mimicking their opinions. Even about seemingly personal and visceral things like who you're attracted to, you will start aping the beliefs of the people around you without even realizing that that's what you're doing. And groups famously follow the opinions of the most dominant or charismatic person in the room, even though there's zero correlation between being the best talker and having the best ideas. I mean, zero. So, much better for everybody to go off by themselves, generate their own ideas, freed from the distortions of group dynamics, and then come together as a team to talk them through in a well-managed environment and take it from there.
When was it that there was this shift away from introversion? I mean, because if you think about historically, like Thoreau, and it was something that was thought to be special. You were thought to be someone who had time with their thoughts, and that was okay. Was there a flip?
Yeah, there was a flip. And historians actually speak about the shift from the so-called culture of character to a culture of personality. And the shift really happened when we had the rise of big business, because what happened is that before the world of big business, we had people kind of living together in small towns, working alongside people they had known all their lives, right? And so they valued people and they valued each other based on who they really were, you know, based on their inner selves. Are you a good person or are you not a good person? But then suddenly, in the era of big business, everybody's moving to the cities and they're no longer working or living with people who they actually know very well. And so what becomes more important are more superficial qualities of, like, you know, are you magnetic? Are you charming? Are you charismatic? That's what started to matter. And then at the same time, we had the rise of movies in general and movie stars who seemed to be like the exact embodiments of all these qualities that people were trying to assume in their day-to-day lives. So it was this kind of perfect storm that created the culture of personality, and that's really the cultural heritage that we're living with today.
You ask for a call to action in your TED Talk.
And so I am going to leave you now with three calls for action for those who share this vision. Number one, stop the madness for constant group work. Just stop it. Thank you. And I want to be clear about what I'm saying, because I deeply believe our offices should be encouraging casual, chatty, cafe-style types of interactions, you know, the kind where people come together and serendipitously have an exchange of ideas. That is great. That's great for introverts, and it's great for extroverts. But we need much more privacy, much more freedom, much more autonomy at work. School, same thing. We need to be teaching kids to work together, for sure. But we also need to be teaching them how to work on their own. This is especially important for extroverted children, too. They need to work on their own because that is where deep thought comes from, in part. Okay, number two, go to the wilderness. Be like Buddha. Have your own revelations. I'm not saying that we all have to now go off and build our own cabins in the woods and never talk to each other again. But I am saying that we could all stand to unplug and get inside our own heads a little more often. Number three, take a good look at what's inside your own suitcase and why you put it there. So extroverts, maybe your suitcases are also full of books, or maybe they're full of champagne glasses or skydiving equipment. Whatever it is, I hope you take these things out every chance you get and grace us with your energy and your joy. But introverts, you being you, you probably have the impulse to guard very carefully what's inside your own suitcase, and that's okay. But occasionally, just occasionally, I hope you will open up your suitcases for other people to see, because the world needs you and it needs the things you carry. So I wish you the best of all possible journeys and the courage to speak softly. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Susan, if people were to take this call to action very seriously, put it in play, leaders, business leaders, world leaders, what's one small thing that you think might change for the better?
Oh, wow. I can actually tell you a big thing that I think would change for the better. I think we'd all get a lot more creative and a lot more productive. I think that we're living with a kind of crazy idea right now that groups are the answer to all creativity and to all productivity. And there's so much research out there that tells us that this is wrong, you know, for extroverts as well as for introverts. I mean, there's 40 years of research on brainstorming that has found that individuals brainstorming on their own produce more ideas and better ideas than groups brainstorming do. So I think that groups play a role, but I think that if we started following a system where we sent people off to really draw on the riches inside their own head and then come together as a group to share things, we would do really well with innovation, and everybody would be more productive.
Susan Cain, thanks for being on the TED Radio Hour.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Allison.
Susan Cain's book is called Quiet: The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. You can find out more about Susan Cain's research. Just go to our website, ted.npr.org. Is brainstorming overrated? Is the Eureka moment a myth?
We've heard a lot recently about, you know, kind of hunch and instinct and kind of blink-like sudden moments of clarity. But in fact, a lot of great ideas linger on, sometimes for decades.
Stephen Johnson on the long incubation period of an idea. That's next on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart. If you've ever had an MRI, this noise is probably not a comforting one.
Kind of has that thump, 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 and then every once in a while I'll go grrr. It's a strange environment to be in, for sure.
That's Doug Dietz.
I'm an innovation architect at GE Healthcare.
About 4 years ago, Doug had finished designing an MRI machine he was pretty proud of.
Really just patting myself on the back.
When his machine was up and running, Doug went to see it in action at a pediatric hospital, excited to watch his design at work. And waiting to be scanned was a girl, about 7 years old. She wasn't so thrilled.
She broke down, her family broke down right there, and they tried to get the anesthesiologist on the phone so they could sedate her to get her in, and he wasn't returning his page, so this is a whole kind of healthcare nightmare thing happening right in front of me. I remember going out in the hallway and just thinking, you know, I've got to change this.
Doug drafted people from the local children's museum, as well as folks who help families through a child's surgery, nurses, parents. All of them collaborated on how they could change the experience of children getting an MRI scan. They also went to the source and just watched kids play.
You know, if you put three kitchen chairs and a blanket and three kids in there, you know, what are they going to do? They're going to make a castle. They're going to make a spaceship. They're going to make a truck. They're going to make all this stuff, and they're going to play forever.
This gave them more direction, the idea of creating an environment where kids will happily play make-believe, even if they are in a hospital. So Doug and his team created the Adventure Series. They transformed the exam rooms into scenes out of a storybook. So the MRI scanner turned into a pirate ship.
And there's like shipwrecks and cool stuff all around the room, and they walk in on a dock and across a plank.
Deep in the jungle.
The graphics on the table look like a hollowed-out canoe.
Or an intergalactic expedition.
The whole magnet looks like a spaceship.
And the technicians play along, too.
So you hear them say things like this. They'll go, we're going to be going into turbo speed here in a minute, so you'll hear the engines going a little bit louder. And then it's so funny, the kids will come out, and they'll go, Mom, did you see how fast I was going?
A scary experience turned into a playground, all with just a little paint and a little imagination.
I guess that right side of my brain that controls daydreaming is really big.
We take ideas from people we've learned from, and we stitch them together into new forms and we create something new. That's really where innovation happens.
That's Stephen Johnson speaking at TED in 2010.
Talking about where good ideas come from. I was talking about the environments that have led to unusually innovative thinking and what we can learn from them.
Stephen Johnson will join us in just a moment, before, right? But let's begin with his TED Talk, where he presented a picture of a very old coffee house.
This is the Grand Cafe here in Oxford. I took this picture because this turns out to be the first coffee house to open in England in 1650. That's its great claim to fame. And I wanted to show it to you not because I want to give you the kind of, you know, Starbucks tour of historic England, but rather because the English coffee house was crucial to the development and spread of one of the great intellectual flowerings of the last 500 years, what we now call the Enlightenment. And the coffee house played such a big role in the birth of the Enlightenment, in part because of what people were drinking there, right? Because before the spread of coffee and tea through British culture, what people drank, both elite and mass folks, drank day in and day out from dawn until dusk was alcohol, right? Alcohol was the daytime beverage of choice. You would drink a little beer with breakfast and have a little wine at lunch, a little gin, particularly around 1650, and top it off with a little beer and wine at the end of the day. That was the healthy choice, right? Because the water wasn't safe to drink. And so effectively, until the rise of the coffee house, you had an entire population that was effectively drunk all day. And you can imagine what that would be like, right, in your own life, and I know this is true of some of you, if you were drinking all day and then you switched from a depressant to a stimulant in your life, you would have better ideas. You would be sharper and more alert. And so it's not an accident that a great flowering of innovation happened as England switched to tea and coffee. But the other thing that makes the coffee house important is the architecture of the space. It was a space where people would get together from different backgrounds, different fields of expertise, and share. It was a space, as Matt Ridley talked about, where ideas could have sex, right? This was their conjugal bed, in a sense. Ideas would get together there. And an astonishing number of innovations from this period have a coffee house somewhere in their story. I've been spending a lot of time thinking about coffee houses for the last 5 years because I've been kind of been on this quest to investigate this question of where good ideas come from. What are the environments that lead to unusual levels of innovation, unusual levels of creativity? What's the kind of environmental, what is the space of creativity?
Stephen, welcome to the TED Radio Hour.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Stephen, the point you wanted to make, and you did make, was that ideas need the proper environment. So is there a universal proper environment?
The way I would describe it is that there are these kind of recurring patterns that show up again and again in environments. It's not fully universal, but there are certain environments that make it a lot easier to have new ideas. And the coffee house is an example of this because it's a multidisciplinary space. It's a space where people are getting together who aren't just working for the same company, but they're working on kind of different kinds of problems. And when you get people who are working on different kinds of problems together and get them talking to each other kind of over their traditional kind of silos and divisions, interesting new possibilities start to happen because people are making these connections across diverse fields.
So once people are in the right kind of environment, one that's got ideas flying and the energy going, what else do you need to help an idea come to fruition?
Well, you know, one of the things that is important is that ideas really initially take form as hunches. They don't come into the world fully realized. The eureka moment, the light bulb moment, is greatly overrated if you look at the history of ideas. In my research, one of the things I found is that while it's always appealing to tell the story that way, it actually is much more likely that ideas take long, long periods of time to develop, and they start as hunches. They're hard to put your finger on what it is drawing you to this particular problem, but you know, the people who are good at coming up with truly disruptive, important new ideas are really good at keeping these hunches alive in their memory and not letting them kind of fade away.
Darwin is a great example of this. Darwin himself, in his autobiography, tells the story of coming up with the idea for natural selection as a classic eureka moment. He's in his study, it's October of 1838, and he's reading Malthus, actually, on population, and all of a sudden, the basic algorithm of natural selection kind of pops into his head, and he says, ah, at last, I had a theory with which to work. That's in his autobiography. About a decade or two ago, a wonderful scholar named Howard Gruber went back and looked at Darwin's notebooks from this period, and Darwin kept these copious notebooks where he wrote down every little idea he had, every little hunch, and what Gruber found was that Darwin had the full theory of natural selection for months and months and months before he had his alleged epiphany reading Malthus in October of 1838. There are passages where you can read it and you think like you're reading from a Darwin textbook. from the period before he has this epiphany. And so what you realize is that Darwin, in a sense, had the idea, he had the concept, but was unable to fully thinking it yet. And that is actually how great ideas often happen. They fade into view over long periods of time.
Stephen, in your talk, you describe how sometimes the best ideas come from necessity. You talk about a medical device that was used to bring down natal death rates. Let's listen.
A wonderful guy named Timothy Prestero, who has a company called, an organization called Design That Matters, they decided to tackle this really pressing problem of the terrible problems we have with infant mortality rates in the developing world. One of the things that's very frustrating about this is that we know by getting modern neonatal incubators into any context, if we can keep premature babies warm, basically, it's very simple, we can have infant mortality rates in those environments. So the technology is there. We have these are standard in all the industrialized worlds. The problem is, if you buy a $40,000 incubator and you send it off to a mid-sized village in Africa, it will work great for a year or 2 years, and then something will go wrong, and it will break, and it will remain broken forever. Because you don't have a whole system of spare parts, and you don't have the on-the-ground expertise to fix this $40,000 piece of equipment. And so you end up having this problem where you spend all this money getting aid and all this advanced electronics to these countries, and then it ends up being useless. So what Prestero and his team decided to do is to look around and see what are the kind of abundant resources in these developing world contexts. And what they noticed was they don't have a lot of DVRs, they don't have a lot of microwaves, but they seem to do a pretty good job of keeping their cars on the road. There's a Toyota 4Runner on the street in all these places. They seem to have the expertise to keep cars working. So they started to think, could we build a neonatal incubator that's built entirely out of automobile parts? And this is what they ended up coming with. It's called the NeoNurture device. From the outside, it looks like a normal little thing you'd find in a modern Western hospital. In the inside, it's all car parts. It's got a fan, it's got headlights for warmth, it's got door chimes for alarm, it runs off a car battery. And so all you need is the spare parts from your Toyota and the ability to fix a headlight, and you can repair this thing.
So, Stephen, in some cases, it isn't about building the best, the most advanced thing, but building the thing that deals with real-world constraints or might be most useful. Is this a shift in the sense of what makes a good idea?
I think it is. I mean, part of the point there is that ideas, by definition, are networks. They're built out of existing other ideas that are around you. No idea comes into the world fully realized, kind of built out of nothing. There are always remixes of other people's ideas and recombinations of other ideas, which is why diverse environments like the coffee house are so important. So if that's the case, then you have to think about that context. In the talk and in the book, I talk about this concept of the adjacent possible. What is available to you? What are the building blocks out there? What are the kind of expectations of your audience or of your consumer? And those are both opportunities and limitations. You know, however smart you are, you cannot invent a microwave oven in 1650. It's not part of the what we call the adjacent possible of that moment. And the folks who were building that amazing neonatal incubator, they were thinking, okay, look, car parts are part of the adjacent possible of this environment, so we can take those parts and use them as building blocks so that this machine will be more durable so that people can fix it. So you have to look around you and figure out what's out there and put yourself in environments where there are, in a sense, more spare parts on the table.
We like to think our breakthrough ideas, you know, are like that $40,000 brand new incubator, state-of-the-art technology. But more often than not, they're cobbled together from whatever parts that happen to be around nearby. And that means that we have to change some of our models of kind of what innovation and deep thinking really looks like.
One of the environments you suggest in your talk and in your book is this sort of chaotic, busy, jostling place where people are exchanging ideas. But one of our other guests on this episode, Susan Cain, the author of Quiet, The Power of Introverts, she believes there's an overemphasis on this group dynamic that introverts who aren't stimulated like that shouldn't be discounted. What are your thoughts?
I followed a little bit of Susan's work, and I think she makes a very good point. I was certainly in this book championing those kind of overstimulated environments. On the other hand, you do need to have time. This is where I think Susan's point is very well taken. You do need to be able to have time to kind of pull away from that and have that time where all that kind of bustle is kind of sorted and processed in your own mind. And so actually in my own life, I've often surrounded myself with lots of interesting people and kind of diverse influences, but I've always had this thing where I almost every night I spend a little bit of time where I just sit and actually just listen to music. I don't answer email or go onto Facebook or even read. I just kind of sit and listen to music. And it's during those quieter periods listening to music when those kind of connections actually start to get useful to me and they actually turn into something that I can do something with. So you have to have balance for sure.
You and Susan Cain do agree that brainstorming is overrated. Why do you think so?
You know, one of the problems with brainstorming is just kind of slotting out this special magic hour where you're supposed to be creative and then the remaining like 39 hours of the week or whatever are supposed to be like doing your job, you know? You know, the important thing is that it's not defined as like, okay, you've got your hour, go to work and think creatively and then go back to your other job. It's something that's happening in the background all the time. And the other problem with brainstorming, I mean, ideas are very much collaborative. I fully believe that you need to get people together and having a conversation, but the problem is that ideas are often out of sync with each other. So the odds are that you'll have exactly the right pieces in that one conference room for that 1 hour. You're much better off creating kind of public online conversations where you can post an idea and someone can discover it and kind of complete the thought 6 weeks later or 6 months later. So you don't have to be all entirely in sync with each other face to face.
Now, the challenge for all of us is, how do you create environments that allow these ideas to have this kind of long half-life, right? It's hard to go to your boss and say, I have an excellent idea for our organization. It will be useful in 2020. Could you just give me some time to do that? Now, a couple of companies like Google, they have innovation time off, 20% time, where in a sense, those are hunch cultivating mechanisms in an organization. But that's a key thing. And the other thing is to allow those hunches to connect with other people's hunches. That's what often happens. You have half of an idea, somebody else has the other half, and if you're in the right environment, they turn into something larger than the sum of their parts. So in a sense, we often talk about the value of protecting intellectual property, you know, building barricades, having secretive R&D labs, patenting everything that we have, so that those ideas will remain valuable and people will be incentivized to come up with more ideas and the culture will be more innovative. But I think there's a case to be made that we should spend at least as much time, if not more, valuing the premise of connecting ideas and not just protecting them.
We're talking to Stephen Johnson about where ideas come from. And Stephen, after listening to your talk a couple of times, I kept thinking a lot of what you're talking about is being sort of literally open-minded to letting other ideas come in and meet up with yours.
That's a really good way of describing it. And I think, you know, there's a kind of an older political, kind of multicultural language about being open-minded and valuing diverse environments, which is good. And it's a nice kind of asset to have in a society or as an individual. But I think what I've been trying to argue is that there's this additional property that you get when you surround yourselves with people or ideas or perspectives that are different from your own, which is that on some basic level, you'll be smarter, right? You'll have more interesting connections. There'll be more building blocks on the table. So it creates a kind of social set of values, almost a political set of values, but it's different. It's not about social justice or tolerance. It's about being more creative and innovative as a society or an organization or as an individual because you've got that kind of diversity at your core.
Stephen, what are some of the myths about where ideas come from that you think just need to be shattered? We need to give it up.
I think that the biggest one is the individual lone genius. There are very smart people out there, but even the brightest of them are standing on the shoulders of giants. You look at somebody like Ben Franklin, who was clearly just incredibly talented and you know a genius on so many different levels, but he had these amazing collaborations with people, and you can see in large part because these things happened through correspondence, and a lot of his correspondence is preserved. So you can see him bouncing these new ideas off people and kind of trying them out and then getting feedback from his colleagues and taking the kind of idea off in a new direction. And so as smart as Franklin was, he needed that network of influence and inspiration to really become the legend of Ben Franklin himself. And so, you know, ideas are almost always better served if you surround yourself with a truly collaborative web. So I think we can learn from that.
That is how innovation happens. Chance favors the connected mind. Thank you very much.
Stephen Johnson, I really enjoyed our talk. Thanks for being on the TED Radio Hour.
I enjoyed it too, Allison. Thanks for having me.
Stephen Johnson. He's the author of the book, Where Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation. You can see another one of Stephen's TED Talks. Just go to TED.com. Our program is produced by Jeff Rogers, Sam Greenspan, and Megan Kane. Special thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Janet Lee, Emily McManus, and Darren Triff. Also thanks to NPR's Eric Newsom. I'm Allison Stewart. You have been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.